From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Pop Music Obsessions, we talk with Nick Hornby about his novel High Fidelity. It's about a record shop owner who defines himself by his top five lists. His top five singles, movies, Elvis Costello songs, and girlfriends who broke up with him. It's just out in paperback. Also, how David Sedaris got the drama bug. Sedaris is a writer, Morning Edition commentator, and author of several off-Broadway plays. The monologue we'll hear is about how he fell in love with theater in high school and all the humiliation that grew out of his new passion. And Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews Courage Under Fire, the new movie starring Meg Ryan and Denzel Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hurricane Bertha is gaining strength as it closes in on the Carolina coast. The storm now has sustained winds of 105 miles an hour, making it a Category 2 hurricane once again. Bertha is about 100 miles south of Wilmington, North Carolina, and it's expected to make landfall sometime this evening. The beaches along the coast near Wilmington are being pounded by heavy rains and rough surf. Eileen LeBlanc of member station WHQR reports.
The sun came up on the coast of North Carolina this morning, but no one in the Cape Fear area has seen it. The barrier islands of Wrightsville and Carolina are dealing with 50 and 60 mile an hour winds, constant rain, and 10-foot seas. Small limbs and other debris are blowing directly away from the ocean. There's a tornado warning for the entire northeast part of the state. In downtown Wilmington, there's minor street flooding, darkness, rain, wind, and desertion. Very few businesses open today. Definitely not your run-of-the-mill Friday. For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Britain's Prince Charles and Princess Diana have agreed on a divorce settlement. Diana gives up any claim to becoming Queen of England, and she will no longer be called Her Royal Highness. But she will retain the title Princess of Wales and technically remain a member of the royal family. Diana will reportedly get a multi-million dollar lump sum settlement plus a yearly allowance. The divorce becomes final on August 28th. For the second straight day, a bomb has exploded on a Moscow trolley bus, injuring over 20 people. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
It was a carbon copy of yesterday's explosion, which injured five. Today's blast ripped through a trolley bus as it headed down a major thoroughfare during the morning rush hour. Once again, there's no indication who carried out the bombing. The mayor of Moscow has not excluded the possibility the bomb might have a Chechen connection, although he's cautioned it's too early to say for sure. The bombings coincide with a new Russian offensive in the breakaway region, where Russian troops, backed by air power and heavy artillery, are attacking Chechen villages they claim are rebel strongholds. President Yeltsin today called for tough action to clean up Moscow, which he said is infested with terrorists. This does not bode well for Chechen residents, who are already regularly harassed by authorities. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A major jump in food costs helped push inflation at the wholesale level up 0.2% last month. Wholesale food prices registered their biggest jump in 6 years, thanks to sharp rises in the cost of beef and pork. But the higher food prices were partially offset by an over 2% drop in wholesale energy costs. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average have turned downward once again. The Dow is down nearly 31 points at 5,489 in moderate trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index has gained a fraction of a point. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has reportedly foiled another coup attempt by disgruntled military officers. At least 50 officers, including two commanders, were said to have been arrested when the plot was uncovered. In the longest study yet conducted, AIDS researchers say combinations of three anti-AIDS drugs seem to be effective in most patients. From Vancouver, Joe Neal reports.
AIDS researchers say preliminary studies suggest that a potent combination of three anti-AIDS drugs can virtually eliminate all traces of the AIDS virus from the bloodstream. In the most striking study presented at the International AIDS Conference, nine volunteers were given AZT plus 3TC and a new protease inhibitor called nelfinavir. Researchers said that the combination caused the virus to disappear completely from the bloodstream, though they're still not sure whether the virus has been eliminated from the brain and lymph nodes. But several doctors caution that the drugs don't work for everyone and that the long-term effects are unknown. Nevertheless, studies here showed that a majority of people do live longer when they take the drug combinations. In Vancouver, I'm Joe Neal reporting.
A backup musician with the Smashing Pumpkins was found dead overnight of what police say was a heroin overdose. 34-year-old Jonathan Melvoin died in his New York hotel room. The Associated Press is reporting that the hit rock group's drummer, Jimmy Chamberlain, has been charged with possession of heroin. A minister who spent 10 years behind bars for sexually abusing half a dozen children has been released from a facility in New York to await the outcome of an appeal. A federal judge has ruled that Reverend Nathaniel Grady was inadequately represented in his earlier appeals. Grady was accused of abusing 6 children at a daycare center. FBI surveillance tapes showed no evidence of abuse. He was convicted on the testimony of the children, but all of them had trouble picking him out in court, and one pointed to the judge instead. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We were delighted to see that one of our favorite novels from 1995 is out in paperback just in time for summer reading. It's Nick Hornby's novel High Fidelity, a hilarious portrait of a certain type of pop culture obsessive, a type you may recognize. Heck, it may be you. The main character, Rob Fleming, owns a used record store. He defines himself and everyone he knows by their taste in music, movies, and books. He compulsively draws up top 5 lists. His top 5 Elvis Costello songs, top 5 American films, top 5 episodes of Cheers. When the book opens, he's drawing up the list of his all-time top 5 worst split-ups with women. In a review in The New Yorker, Rob Nixon wrote, "It is rare that a book so hilarious is also so sharp about sex and manliness, memory, and music." High Fidelity will be adapted into a movie by director Mike Newell, who made 4 Weddings and a Funeral. Let's start with a reading from High Fidelity that will give you a sense of how Rob, the record store owner, and his employees, Dick and Barry, evaluate people by their taste in pop culture.
A while back, when Dick and Barry and I agreed that what really matters is what you like, not what you are like, Barry proposed the idea of a questionnaire for prospective partners, a 2 or 3 page multiple choice document that covered all the music, film, TV, book bases. It was intended A, to dispense with awkward conversation, and B, to prevent a chap from leaping into bed with someone who might, at a later date, turn out to have every Julio Iglesias record ever made. It amused us at the time, although Barry, being Barry, went one stage further. He compiled the questionnaire and presented it to some poor woman he was interested in, and she hit him with it. But there was an important and essential truth contained in the idea, and the truth was that these things matter, and it's no good pretending that any relationship has a future if your record collections disagree violently, or if your favourite films wouldn't even speak to each other if they met at a party.
Well, that's the theory of how his relationships work. You know, you have to find somebody whose taste conforms to yours, and taste is everything. Let's hear how this works in practice. I'm going to ask you to skip ahead to page 161, when a friend of the main characters, has met a woman. The problem is this woman doesn't have very good taste in music. Why don't you read it?
"Anna's a Simple Minds fan," Dick confides. "Oh, right. I don't know what to say. This, in our universe, is a staggering piece of information. We hate Simple Minds. They were number 1 in our top 5 bands or musicians will have to be shot come the musical revolution. Michael Bolton, U2, Brian Adams, and, surprise, surprise, Genesis were tucked in behind them. Barry wanted to shoot the Beatles, but I pointed out that someone had already done it. It is as hard for me to understand how he's ended up with a Simple Minds fan as it would be to fathom how he'd paired off with one of the royal family or a member of the shadow cabinet. It's not the attraction that baffles, so much as how on earth they got together in the first place."
Well, Nick Hornby, is this an obsession you understand, measuring the whole world by taste?
I understand it. I don't necessarily share it, but I've certainly had my moments, I think.
How obsessed are you with your favorites in books, records, television, movies, and other people's?
I'm always very interested in other people's stuff. and I guess it's something that I want to know fairly quickly. But I don't think I'm alone in this, and I think a lot of men in particular are like that, and they'd rather kind of cut to the chase in conversation and just get people to list things, really.
So do you think that the male aspect is the list aspect, you know, the quantifying aspect, or just the obsession with taste?
I think the quantifying aspect is very important.
Now, I confess I really am baffled when people get together who don't share the same taste. I mean, if somebody, like, is obsessed with movies and starts a relationship with someone who doesn't like to go to the movies, you wonder, are their inner lives compatible?
Yeah, I would say that they probably aren't. I think it probably gets easier as you get older to form relationships and to find points of contact that aren't based on taste. But I think at the times when one is forming relationships, these things are very important.
Pauline Kael, the film critic, once wrote in one of her essays that I think she broke up with someone after they saw West Side Story together because he loved the film and she detested it, and she just couldn't imagine seeing him anymore after that. Have you ever been through something like that?
No, a friend has. Quite recently, they had an argument because a woman described a TV movie as a great film, and you could feel the doubt in his voice, you know, from a very early stage from thereafter, and it really didn't last very long.
Nick Hornby is my guest. His new novel is called High Fidelity. Now, the main character owns a record store. How familiar are you with record store culture?
Well, I've never worked in one, but I guess I've spent a lot of time in them, so I'm pretty familiar.
Why don't you describe the record store that your main character owns, Championship Vinyl?
Well, it's a rather seedy second-hand store for collectors, really. And it sells pretty well all vinyl, I would imagine. They don't have that conversation, but when I imagined it in my head, it's just rackfuls of vinyl. It's pretty empty most of the time. So the three guys who work there spend most of their time arguing with each other. And they don't make a lot of sales. And it sells, I suppose, the pop music canon. You know, if Harold Bloom has a canon, these guys have a canon. And it's kind of R&B, new wave, 60s rock, all the kinds of things that rock critics would approve of, really.
Plus a little ska.
Oh, yeah.
Now, some of the customers in this record store are people who really virtually have no life outside of looking for rare singles. About one customer, the main character thinks, I can't imagine telling him anything of a remotely personal nature, that I had a mother and father, say, or that I'd been to school when I was younger. I reckon he'd just blush and stammer and ask if I'd heard the new Lemonheads album. What made you think of a character like that? Do you find a lot of people like that who seem to have no life and who live in book or record stores?
Yeah, well, it was the thing, I guess, that interested me about people like the characters in the book is that what they listen to all the time is incredibly emotive, and yet they're very anal about stuff. And so there's this great dissonance between the music and its consumers, and it was that sort of area that I wanted to write about.
You know, I find with people who are obsessive about music or books or whatever, that there's the kind of person who just has the list, who just has, well, these are my favorites, I like this, I don't like that. And then there's the person who has just a whole kind of constellation of thoughts surrounding it, and for who those lists represent, a kind of like deep inner life and a rich sensibility. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. I mean, I guess it's the difference between a rock critic and a rock fan a lot of the time. And I think music is a terribly hard thing to write about. And people like Peter Guralnick and Graham Marcus, who are capable of these, they have very defined tastes, but they are capable of striking sparks and thoughts off their lists, as it were, whereas there's a sort of lumpen rock fan who just can't do anything with a list apart from know that this is the stuff he likes.
Now, where does your character fit into that?
Well, the central character, I think, is emerging from an obsession with pop music. I mean, his 35th birthday takes place during the narrative of the book, and he's beginning to think that it's about time he did something else or thought about something else, but he's not really sure what those things are to think about. So he's kind of in between two camps, really, which is quite an uncomfortable place for him to be.
One of his early girlfriends back in 1973, her top five recording artists were Carly Simon, Carole King, James Taylor, Cat Stevens, and Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character thinks, I can imagine what sort of person she became, a nice person. Tell me how you chose that list for this early girlfriend.
Well, I guess that was pretty much a composite of the record collections that I saw in girlfriends' bedrooms at the time in the mid-70s. And they were all, one of those artists was always represented in any collection that I saw.
You know, an interesting thing is a lot of times, and I think this is particularly true of boys and men, they want to be the mentor in a relationship. So they'll almost like seek out somebody who's younger or at least more inexperienced or uneducated in something so that they can teach them.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I think it's very representative and very common male behavior. And in the book In High Fidelity, Rob Fleming spends a lot of his time making compilation tapes for women that he meets, and it's you know, I guess it's like in a rather unpleasant way, it's like dogs and lampposts, and it's setting your mark in some way, and to that extent virgin ears are very important to that kind of man.
And tell us more about the compilation tapes he makes and how he uses them.
Well, they are a kind of means of seduction. And he meets Laura, who's the other central character in the book, at a club where he's a DJ, and he offers to make her a compilation tape of the music that she's been listening to and dancing to in this club. And so that becomes a very important thing, that he has introduced her to all sorts of things, and then there's an echo of that later on where he meets somebody else and he finds himself making a tape for her too, and Laura sees him and knows exactly what he's doing. But he has very strict rules about compilation tapes, about what kind of music can go next to what kind of music, and he can't have black music and white music together, and you can't have fast stuff and slow stuff together. He has to build all these little bridges between tracks. So he's very finickety about the compilation tapes.
You know, I have to tell you, I've always found that kind of that male urge to mentor a girlfriend kind of mm-hmm. irritating.
Yeah, I should think it is, actually.
Yeah, it's like somebody who doesn't want an equal, so someone who doesn't want somebody they could share an interest with, but they want to be able to, like, teach it.
Yeah, and it, really, you're trying to turn the other person into a female version of yourself,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of defeats the point of the relationship.
Exactly. Really. Right. Nick Hornby is my guest. He's the author of the new novel, High Fidelity. Let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nick Hornby, and his new novel, High Fidelity, is about somebody who owns a used record store and is just totally obsessed with pop culture, with records and books and movies and television, and is constantly drawing up top five lists about all of the above. Now, what about your top five singles of all time? Do you have such a list?
I guess the permanent number one is Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On, which I think is the greatest piece of pop music ever made. And then the four after that change periodically, but there's always something like Hey Jude in there, and I have a residual fondness for Maggie May by Rod Stewart. So those three are always there or thereabouts.
Now, when you were writing this book, did you have to do any research, so to speak? Did you hang out at a record store or observe certain people who you thought were really close to the character that you created for your book? Or did you just already know all this stuff inside out?
I think, really, I knew the stuff inside out. There's some stuff about women's underwear in there.
Which, I was just going to mention that. That's a really funny part. I mean, this is a character who is really disappointed because, you know, he finally figures out that women save their best, really sexy lingerie for Saturday nights when they expect to actually be sleeping with someone. But then when you actually move in with the woman, there's these kind of like tattered, torn undies all over the radiators hanging up to dry.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that obviously came from bitter experience. But but I did check it out with a lot of women friends. And so that was my one piece of research, was to ask women about their underwear.
And did they concur that that was true?
Yeah, they did, yeah. I'm getting a nod here from the studio as well.
This is that was your engineer.
Yeah, that's right.
In England, yeah. Nodding.
Yeah.
So how big is your record collection? I'll move the subject off of underwear for a moment.
I guess I have 700 or 800 vinyl albums and a few hundred CDs and quite a few tapes as well. So I've got to the stage when I have most things I want, really.
That's actually pretty modest by collecting standards.
Yeah, I'm not really a collector, and I have ditched loads of stuff as I've got older, which Rob Fleming, the guy in the book, would never do. I mean, he'd never get rid of anything, and because he uses his records as a kind of autobiography, whereas I practiced a sort of Stalinist rewriting of history.
So, what do you mean?
Well, so, you know, you sell all the dodgy heavy metal albums, that all the Black Sabbath records that I bought when I was 16 and now no longer to be found in my record collection.
Did you ever have to divide up a record collection after living with somebody for an amount of time?
No, I've always kept things very separate.
Now, how do you keep your record collection? Just alphabetized, straightforwardly?
Alphabetized, but with the first names first, so Bob Dylan would be under B.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I've always had a problem. I've always found this problem with certain artist groups, like you know, like the Jay Giles Band. If you walk into a record store, you never know whether to go to J or G, and it's firmly under J in my collection. I think it makes sense.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess this answers the Sun Ra question. I mean, it would
absolutely
help you deal
yeah.
with that.
Sun Ra, there's a band that used to be here called Danny Wilson, and everyone in the record store thought that Danny Wilson was a solo artist, so they always put their records under W. But it was actually from the Frank Sinatra film,
right.
Danny Wilson. So, again, you see, that's the kind of little problem that this clears up. And I recommend it to all your listeners.
Have you ever wanted to call a moratorium on taste? So that no, for a day, nobody would have any taste. and you wouldn't be thinking, well, what do they really like and what does that say about them? And what do I really like and what does that say about me?
Yeah, I think it is a terribly burdensome thing. But those habits are so deeply ingrained that it's, I think, very hard not to judge. But it would be nice, yes. John Lennon should sing a song about it. But imagine, imagine there's no Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, it's easy if you try.
Your main character in your novel works in a record store, then owns a record store. A lot of people, particularly like writers, musicians, often work in book or record stores before being able to make a living as a performer or a writer. You apparently didn't go that route, but what kind of jobs did you have before you actually were able to make a living as a writer?
Well, I was a teacher for some years, and later on, as I started to write a bit more, I was a part-time teacher. And then I got a job working for a very large Korean multinational company as a kind of dog's body.
Excuse me, a what?
An English expression, a dog's body, where, you know, you just do what they tell you to do. But anything where it was easier to be English than to be Korean, then I did the job. So I did a lot of letter writing and some speech writing and shopping and arranging and all kinds of things like that. I was actually paid very well and I didn't have to work very many hours, so it was an ideal job. That was the last job I had before I became a full-time writer.
Now, did you know then you wanted to write?
I'd always wanted to write since I was about 16 or 17. I guess like most people do, and also like most people, I actually didn't do a thing about it. Each new job that I got, I just thought, well, I'm going to be a writer someday. And then it occurred to me that I actually had to sit down and do some stuff if that was ever going to happen. So it took me a long time before I sat down and did it. But I'd known for a long time that I wanted to.
Well, Nick Hornby, I'd like to end with one of your favorite records. You want to choose a record to end with? It could be your favorite single of all time or something else.
Well, I think I'd choose the favorite single of all time. I'd like to hear Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye.
And defend your choice.
Because it's sort of 3.5 minutes long, which is the length that pop music should be. It has more voices than just about any other record since the Hallelujah Chorus, and they're all Marvin Gaye's voice, which is a beautiful voice. And it's a very sexy record as well.
I want to thank you a whole lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nick Hornby is the author of the novel High Fidelity, which has just come out in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Sedaris tells us how he got the drama bug in high school. And Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews the new movie, Courage Under Fire. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. From time to time lately, we've been bringing you excerpts from a new public radio program we're excited about called This American Life. This American Life is heard on a few dozen public radio stations around the country. Today's excerpt is a story by David Sedaris. He's a writer and Morning Edition commentator and the author of several off-Broadway plays. He writes one every year for his sister Amy to star in. His most recent was called One Woman's Shoe and got rave reviews in the New York Times and just about everywhere else it was reviewed. Sedaris fell in love with theater in high school, and that's what the subject of his story today is.
The man was sent to our school in order to inspire us, and personally speaking, I thought he did an excellent job. After introducing himself in a relaxed and casual manner, he started towards the back of the room, only to be stopped midway by what we came to know as the invisible wall, that transparent barrier realized only by mimes, drug addicts, and certain varieties of rapid cycling psychotics. I sat enthralled as he righted himself and began investigating the imaginary wall with his open palms, running his hands over the hard, smooth surface in hopes of finding a way out. Moments later, he was tugging at an invisible rope, then struggling in the face of a violent, fantastic wind. You know you're living in a small town when you can reach the ninth grade without ever having seen a mime. As far as I was concerned, this man was a prophet, a genius, a pioneer in the field of entertainment, and here he was in Raleigh, North Carolina. It was a riot the way he imitated the teacher, turning down the corners of his mouth and rifling through his imaginary purse in search of gum and aspirin. Was this guy funny or what? I went home and demonstrated the invisible wall for my infant brother, who pounded at the very real wall beside his bed, shrieking and wailing in disgust. When my mother asked what I'd done to provoke him, I threw up my hands in mock innocence before lowering them to retrieve the imaginary baby which lay fussing at my feet. I patted the back of my little ghost in order to induce gas and was investigating its soiled diaper when I noticed my mother's face assume an expression she reserved for unspeakable horror. I had seen this look only twice before, once when she was caught in the path of a charging, rabid pig, and once again when I told her I wanted a peach-colored velveteen blazer with matching slacks. I don't know who put you up to this, she said, but I'll kill you myself before I watch you grow up to be a clown. You want a diaper, a baby? Make yourself useful and wipe up the genuine article. She handed me my brother before turning to leave the room. Because I respected her opinion, I did as I was told, ending my career in mime with a whimper rather than the silent bang I had hoped for. The visiting actor returned to the classroom a few months later, removing his top coat to reveal a black body stocking worn with a putty-colored neck brace, the result of a recent automobile accident. This afternoon's task was to introduce us to the works of William Shakespeare, and once again I was completely captivated by his charm and skill. When the words became confusing, you needed only pay attention to the actor's face and hands to know that this particular character was not just angry, but vengeful. I loved the undercurrent of hostility that lay beneath the surface of this deceptively beautiful language. It seemed a shame that people no longer spoke this way, and I undertook a campaign to reintroduce Elizabethan English to the citizens of Raleigh.
Perchance, fair lady, thou dost think me unduly vexed at the sorrowful state of thine quarters, I said to my mother as I ran the vacuum over the living room carpet she was inherently too lazy to bother with. These foul specks, the evidence of life itself, have sullied not only thine shag-tempered mat, but also thine character. Be ye mad, woman? Were it a crime to neglect thine dwellings, you, my feeble-spirited mistress, would hang from the tallest venerable tree in penance for your shameful ways. Be there not linens to both launder and iron free of turbulence? See ye not the porcelain plates and hardy mugs waiting to be washed clean of evidence? Get thee to thine work, damnable lady, and quickly, before the products of thine very loins raise their collected fists in a spirit born of rage and indignation, forcibly coaxing the last breath from the foul chamber of thine vain and upright throat. Go now, wastrel, and get to it.
This time, my mother, a high school dropout, was caught off guard. Members of her immediate family had done time in some serious mental institutions, and something suggested I might be next. I could tell by the state of my room that she spent the next day searching my dresser for drugs. The clothes I took pride in neatly folding were crammed tight into the drawers with no regard for color or category. I smelled the evidence of cigarettes and noticed the coffee rings left on my desk. I loved my mother dearly, but mess with mine drawers and ye have just made thyself an enemy. Tying a feather to the shaft of my ballpoint pen, I quilled her a letter. The thing that ye search for so desperately resideth not in mine well-ordered chambers, but in the questionable content of thine own character. I slipped the note into her purse, folded twice and sealed with wax from the candles I now used to light my room. I took to brooding, refusing to let up until I received a copy of Shakespeare's collected plays. Reading them, though, just didn't provide the kick I'd hoped for. I found it more enjoyable to simply carry the book from room to room, occasionally skimming for fun words I might toss into my ever-fragrant vocabulary. The dinner hour became either unbearable or excruciating, depending on my mood.
Methinks, kind sir, most gentle lady, fellow siblings all, that this barnyard fowl be most tasty and succulent, having simmered in its own sweet juices for such a time as it might take the sun to pass, rosy and full-fingered, across the plum-colored sky for the course of a twilight hour. 'Tis crisp yet juicy, this plump bird, satisfied in the company of such finely roasted neighbors. Hear me out, fine relations, and heed my words, for me thinks it adventurous and fanciful, too, to saddle mine fork with both fowl and carrot at the exact same time, the twin juices blending together in a delicate harmony which doth cajole and enliven the tongue in a spirit of unbridled merriment. What say ye, fine father, sisters, and infant brother, too, that we raise our flagons high in celebration of this hearty feast? Prepared lovingly and with tender grace by this dutiful woman we have the good fortune to address as our wife, wench, or mother.
My enthusiasm knew no limits, and as a result, it quickly reached the point where my mother literally begged me to wait in the car while she stepped into the bank or the grocery store. I was at the orthodontist's office, placing a pox upon the practice of dentistry when the visiting actor returned to our classroom. "You missed it," my friend Lois said. "The man was so indescribably powerful that I was practically crying. That's how brilliant he was. I can't describe it any better than that." She placed her chin in her hand and stared out the window into the parking lot. There's absolutely nothing left for me to say about it, nothing. I could try to explain his realness, but you'd never be able to understand it. Lois and I had been friends for 6 months when our relationship suddenly took on a competitive edge. I'd never cared who made better grades or had the most spending money. We each had our strengths. The important thing was to honor one another for the thing they did best. Lois complained better than I did, and I respected her for that. Her grotesque excess of self-confidence allowed her to march into school wearing a rust-colored afro wig, and I stood behind her 100%. She had more records than I did, and because she was a year older, she also knew how to drive a car and did so as if she were rushing to a fire. Fine, I thought, good for her. I was genuinely happy for Lois until she questioned my ability to understand the visiting actor. I was the one who identified his brilliance in the first place, me, not her. Sure, she'd been there beside me in the classroom, but she didn't even realize that was an invisible wall until I told her. When he'd come in with his Shakespeare, she'd been just like the rest of them, laughing at his neck brace and rolling her eyes at the tangerine-sized lump in his tights. Now she was telling me that I couldn't understand him?
Me thank not. Honestly, woman, I said to my mother on our way to the dry cleaner, to think that this low-lying worm might speak to me of greatness as though it were a thing invisible to mine eyes is more than I can bear. Her words doth strike mine heart with the force of a punishing blow, leaving me both stunned and highly vexed too. Hear me, though, for I shall bide my time quietly and with cunning, striking back at the very hour she doth least expect it. Such an affront shall not go unchallenged. Of that you may rest assured, gentle mother. My vengeance will hold the sweet taste of the ripest berry, and I shall savor it slowly and with gusto. You'll get over it, my mother said. Give it a few weeks and the whole thing will blow over. This had become her answer to everything. She'd done some asking around and concluded that I'd been bitten by what her sister called the drama bug. My mother was convinced that this was just a phase like all the others, a few weeks of prancing and I'd drop show business just like I had the guitar in my private detective agency. I hated having my life's ambition reduced to the level of a common cold. This wasn't a bug, but a full-fledged virus. It might lay low for a year or two, but this little germ would never go away. It had nothing to do with talent. Rejection wouldn't weaken it, and no amount of success could ever satisfy it. The drama bug strikes hardest with Jews, homosexuals, and plump women who wear their hair in bangs. These are people who, for one reason or another, desperately crave attention. I would later learn that it's a bad idea to gather more than two of these people in an enclosed area for any amount of time. Stage is not an actual place, but rather a state of mind related to one's whereabouts during the time you're not asleep. Audience defines anyone pausing long enough for you to interrupt. We were a string of light bulbs left burning 24 hours a day, and as a result, our exhausted public soon stopped wondering what all the fuss was about.
We're listening to a monologue by David Sedaris. There's more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to David Sedaris' story, Drama Bug.
I had the drama bug, and Lois had a car. This being the case, I quickly forgave her when informed that the visiting actor had scheduled a production of Hamlet, set to take place at the amphitheater of the Raleigh Rose Garden. He himself would direct and play the title role, but the other parts were up for grabs. We went to the audition, and because we were the youngest, Lois and I were assigned the roles of the traveling players Hamlet uses to bait his Uncle Claudius. It wasn't the part I was hoping for, but I accepted it with a quiet dignity. I still had a few speeches and planned to use them to the best of my ability, outshining the other actors who were all much older than I. They were in their 20s and 30s and carried years of experience in such long-running outdoor dramas as The Lost Colony and Tender as the Lamb. These were professionals, and I hoped to benefit from their experience, sitting literally at their feet as the director paced the lip of the stage, addressing his clenched fist as, "Poor Yorick." I worshiped these people. Lois slept with them. By the second week of rehearsal, she had taken up with Laertes, who, she claimed, had a real way with the sword. Unlike me, she was embraced by the older crowd, attending late-night keg parties with Polonius and Ophelia, driving to the lake with the director while Gertrude and Rosencrantz made out in the back seat. The killer was that Lois was nowhere near as committed as I was. Her drama bug was the equivalent of a 24-hour flu, yet there she was, swimming naked with the director himself while I practiced lines alone in my room.
As traveling players, it was decided that we would make our entrance tumbling onto the stage. When Lois complained that the grass was irritating her skin, the director examined the wee pimples on her back and decided that, rather than tumbling, the players would enter skipping. I had practiced my tumble until my brain lost its mooring and could be heard rattling in my skull, and now, on the basis of one complaint, we were skipping? He'd already cut out all of my speeches, leaving me with one line, "Aye, my lord." While the other actors strolled the rose gardens memorizing their vengeful soliloquies, I skipped back and forth across the parking lot, whispering, "Aye, my lord. Aye, my lord." Lois felt silly skipping and spoke to the director, who praised her instincts and announced that henceforth the players would enter walking. The less I had to do, the more my fellow actors used me as a personal slave. I would have been happy to help them run lines, but instead they wanted me to polish their crowns or trot out to the car and search the floorboards for their dagger. "Looking for something to do? You can help Dugan glow tape the stage," the director said. "You can chase the spiders out of the dressing room, or better yet, run to the store. Who wants drinks?" Not only did Lois lay in the shade doing nothing, but she was the first one to hand me a $20 bill when placing an order for a 30-cent candy bar. During rehearsal breaks, she huddled with the actors while I was off anchoring ladders for one of the technicians. When it came time for our big scene, Lois recited her lines as if she were reading the words from the surface of some distant billboard. She squinted and paused between syllables, punctuating each word with a question mark. If the director had a problem with her performance, he kept it to himself. I, on the other hand, I needed to remove the sweater from around my neck, walk slower, and drop the accent. It might have been easier to accept the criticism had he spread it around a little, but that seemed unlikely. She could enter the stage with a slice of pizza in one hand and a Dr. Pepper in the other, and that was fine, Lois, just great. By this point, I was finding my own way home from rehearsal. Lois couldn't give me a ride if she was always rushing off to some party or restaurant with what she referred to as the gang from Elsinore. I would wave them off and wait in the parking lot for one of my parents to drive me home. "The thing to remember," my mother said, "is that 10 years from now you could wake up underneath one of these people and have no idea you'd ever even seen them before. Time passes, you'll see. Enough liquor and people can forget anything. Don't let it get you. If nothing else, it's taught you to skim the change while buying their drinks." I didn't appreciate her casual attitude, but the business with the change was insightful. My mother had the vengeful part down. It was the craft of acting I thought she knew nothing about. We were in dress rehearsal when the director approached Lois in regards to a production he had planned for the fall. This was to be a musical based on the lives of roving gypsies, and he had her in mind for the role of a lusty bandit. Lois couldn't sing. Everybody knew that. Neither could she act or play the tambourine. I watched the man kneel down in the grass and literally beg her to accept the part. When I expressed an interest, he suggested I might enjoy working behind the scenes in some backstage capacity. He meant for me to hang lights or lug scenery, to turn into one of those guys with low-riding pants and a belt burdened with wrenches and thick rolls of gaffer's tape. Anyone thinking I might be trusted with electrical wiring had to be a complete idiot, and that's what this man was. I looked at him clearly then, noticing how his tights made a mockery of his slack calves and dumpy little basket. If he was such a big stinking deal, what was he doing in Raleigh, North Carolina? His blow-dried hair, the Cuban-heeled shoes and rainbow-striped suspenders, it was all a sham. Why wear tights with suspenders when their only redeeming feature was that they promised to stay up on their own? And acting? The man performed as though everyone around him sported a shrimp-sized hearing aid clamped to their ear. He shouted his lines, grinning like a jack-o'-lantern and flailing his hands as if he were fighting off gnats. His was a form of acting that never fails to embarrass me. It's the same feeling I get when watching someone hawk a vegetable slicer or deliver a singing telegram. You know it's supposed to sound convincing, but you can't get beyond the sad fact that this person actually thinks he's bringing some joy into your life. Somewhere he's got a mother sifting through a shoebox of mimeographed playbills, pouring herself another drink and wondering when her son is going to come to his senses and swallow some drain cleaner. I saw Hamlet for the man he was, and in the process saw myself as a sort of sad sack Yorick who would blindly follow along behind him. My parents attended the opening night performance. Following my lord, I laid on the grass as Lois poured a false vial of poison into my ear. As I lay dying, I opened my eyes enough to see my father sleeping, my mother stretched out beside him, fighting off the moths who, along with a few dozen humans, had been attracted by the bright light. There was a cast party afterwards, but I didn't go. I changed my clothes in the dressing room where the actors stood congratulating one another. Horatio asked me to run to the store for some cigarettes, and I pocketed his money, promising to return with lightning speed. "You were the best in the whole show," my mother said, stopping for frozen pizza on our way home. "I mean it. You walked onto that stage and all eyes went right for you." It occurred to me then that my mother was a better actor than I could ever hope to be. Acting is different than posing or pretending. When done well, it bears a striking resemblance to lying. I didn't envy my mother's skill, neither did I contradict her. That's how convincing she was. It seemed best, sitting beside her with a frozen pizza thawing on my lap, to simply sit back and learn.
David Sedaris' story, Drama Bug, will appear in his forthcoming book, Naked. His earlier pieces are collected in the book, Barrel Fever. Drama Bug was first heard on the radio show, This American Life. It was produced by Elise Spiegel and Ira Glass, the show's host. This American Life comes from WBEZ in Chicago and is heard on a few dozen public stations around the country. We'll feature more excerpts in the weeks to come. Coming up, a review of the new film, Courage Under Fire. This is Fresh Air. The next big summer movie is high on stars and low on special effects. Courage Under Fire stars Denzel Washington and Meg Ryan. Critic Lisa Schwartzbaum says, finally, a summer movie for grown-ups.
Courage Under Fire is a drama set during the 1991 Persian Gulf War. It stars Denzel Washington as Lieutenant Colonel Nathaniel Serling, an armored tank commander who mistakenly destroys one of his own tanks with friendly fire during heavy combat. So, while the Pentagon quietly investigates and buries the matter, he's assigned to a desk job. And one of his duties is to review the candidacy of medevac pilot Karen Walden for a Medal of Honor, a posthumous medal. As Serling looks into what should be a cut-and-dry case, Walden's surviving troops tell very conflicting stories about what exactly happened. I think that counts as grown-up stuff. It also makes for powerful drama. Courage Under Fire is sure to be called Rashomon-like because, as in Kurosawa's classic study, different people tell different versions of the truth. But courage is not so much about versions as it is about the pain of accepting the big truth. War is hell, and sometimes mistakes are made, and sometimes ordinary people do brave or cowardly things. Patrick Sheen Duncan, who wrote the script, previously wrote and directed a whole cable series on the subject of Medals of Honor. Director Ed Zwick, meanwhile, an unusually thoughtful and compassionate Hollywood denizen who directed Washington in the sweeping 1989 Civil War saga Glory, creates a deeply moving portrait of military pride and prejudice. I think that counts as grown-up stuff, too. Not that there aren't some weak spots. The military machine, represented by Michael Moriarty as Serling's superior officer and mentor, takes a huge hit as an outfit hell-bent on covering its mistakes and pressured by the White House to provide misty-eyed, morale-building photo ops. That's why they want to rush through Walden's medal and why they don't want to explain Serling's mistakes to a grieving family. Here, tempers rise as Serling, obsessed by the need to exorcise his own guilt, confronts his general.
Will there be a public statement of the facts when the Albothra investigation is over, sir?
There's been a decision not to release any of these findings until every case has been thoroughly reviewed.
Well, how long do you imagine that will be, sir? I mean, next time I see Lieutenant Boyle's parents, I'd like to be able to tell them the whole truth.
Do you want to know how many grieving parents I had to deal with during Vietnam?
With all due respect, sir, this is not Vietnam. Now, Lieutenant Boyle's tank was hit by uranium-depleted shells. We are the only country in the world that uses them. We got these reporters from the Washington Post sniffing around his parents looking for the truth, and the only person that knows the truth is not allowed to say it because these investigators are dragging their backsides. Someone has got to be accountable for this.
You almost expect Jack Nicholson to pound the table like in A Few Good Men, shouting, "You can't handle the truth!" Courage Under Fire is, in its way, a courageous movie for a 1990s war story. It dares to show realistic scenes of combat. It dares to treat soldiers as individuals, each with strengths and weaknesses. Serling, for one thing, has begun to hit the bottle. It even includes an admirable, intelligent member of the press, a Washington Post reporter played with great warmth by Scott Glenn. Best of all, Zwick has the talent to pull from his performers some of the best work they've ever done. Practically all of Meg Ryan's cuticisms have been dropped here. Her voice is low and strong, there's a focus to her actions, and only the pink glossy lipstick she wears in combat gives her away as a movie star. Lou Diamond Phillips and Matt Damon do great work as survivors of Walden's command. Regina Taylor, who, for my money, glows with dignity in everything I've ever seen her in, from I'll Fly Away to Clockers, is Serling's strong wife. And Denzel Washington gives, well, I'd say he gives the performance of his career, except he'll probably do it again the next time because he's that good an actor. It's Washington's fierce control, passion, and pure skill that give Courage Under Fire its flame of brilliance. He's a grown-up actor. And that, in this summer of kid-like movie stars, is the highest award I can bestow.
Lisa Schwartzbaum is writer-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.